At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The problem of the uninsured is becoming increasingly difficult for governors and state legislatures to ignore. Washington may have turned its back on major health care reform, but some 20 states are debating or have approved laws recently to expand coverage of the uninsured. Just this week, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich signed into law a plan to provide all Illinois children, including those in working and middle-class families, with health insurance. And in Massachusetts, the state legislature is debating a plan even more ambitious to cover virtually all of the state's 500,000 uninsured residents. The plan is generous but controversial. Can it work? And if so, will it provide a model for other states struggling with what many call a growing crisis of the uninsured? This hour on Point, the role the states are playing in the debate over expanding coverage for the uninsured. You can join the conversation. What do you think states should do to provide health coverage for the uninsured? Is it fair to raise taxes on businesses? Is it realistic to impose mandates on individuals? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio to talk first about the Massachusetts proposal is John McDonough. He's executive director of Healthcare for All, a consumer health advocacy organization in Boston. And welcome, John. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. Let's talk about this plan in Massachusetts. But first of all, before we get into some of the particulars, tell us what's going on in this state in terms of the uninsured and why you feel something needs to be done with such urgency.
Well, we're seeing an alarming growth in the rate of uninsurance in Massachusetts. Since the year 2000, we've had about a 50% increase in the number of uninsured, and the numbers are growing worse.
And what are the numbers? I mean, a state the size of Massachusetts.
So Massachusetts, out of about 6.4 million people, the best estimate we find is about 530,000 uninsured, up from about 360,000 in 2000. And behind it all is really what we can see is a meltdown nationally and in Massachusetts of employer-sponsored coverage. The Kaiser Family Foundation in 2000 estimated 69% of employers offered coverage to their workers, and today that number is down to 60%. That's an extraordinary drop in just 5 years. It's kind of a polar ice cap melting of employer-sponsored coverage, which is how most people in the United States have been getting health insurance for the past 60 or so years.
And why that melt? Why is employer-based health care coverage declining like this?
It is all tied to the rising cost of health insurance, which has been growing at double-digit rates for at least the past 5 years. The cost is unsustainable for individuals and families, for employers, and for government at all levels, for particularly the state government and municipal government. So everybody's screaming and everybody's adjusting, and unfortunately, it's leading to uninsurance and to also an enormous shift in co-payments, deductibles, and other cost-sharing to consumers.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this Massachusetts plan, both because it's interesting, but as well as sort of an example that the states are taking on to deal with this melting polar ice cap, as you appropriately suggest as a metaphor. And let's make clear, first of all, that this is still a proposal. It was passed by the state house, not necessarily supported by the Senate or a Republican governor. Still, it's creating a lot of buzz. You support it. Tell us why it deserves to be taken seriously. What are the key components of this plan?
It's really unique. I don't think there's ever been a debate like this in any state in the country in the past 25 years. And it gets to two things. Number one, what should be the role, responsibility of employers in the system, and what should be the role and responsibility of individuals? And historically, people on the political left, the progressive side, like employer responsibility, employer mandates, and don't like individual mandates or individual responsibilities. Folks on the political right, it's vice versa. They like individual mandates and they don't like employer mandates. And the default has always been to do neither. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting in Massachusetts right now is that there's a plan that passed our House of Representatives by a comfortable veto-proof margin, which does both. It says within certain limits, employers are going to have to be responsible to pay something, not the cost of full health insurance, but something to support workers if they don't provide coverage. And individuals within certain affordability limits will also be responsible and have to step up to the plate and also make sure that they are covered.
Mm-hmm. Now, two things here. I mean, so it sounds like it's both tough and generous. It's going to tax most employers, sort of mid-sized to large companies. Little companies with 10 employees or less wouldn't be taxed, but a lot of companies would. And we're already hearing objections from the business community in Massachusetts that this can't fly. You're going to tax us out of business or worse, push us out of state.
Well, what's interesting is that the employers who don't provide coverage, and this is true in every state and it's been documented in Massachusetts, are the companies that are not mobile. A survey that the state did last February that showed employers who have workers using state-sponsored coverage through our Medicaid program or other sources, that the number one employer doing that is Dunkin' Donuts. Now, Dunkin' Donuts can close shops and move to New Hampshire, but they don't take their business with them. So uninsurance is significantly a phenomenon of employers in retail, service, food service, construction industry who aren't mobile. The employers who are mobile, who could move from Massachusetts to North Carolina or Taiwan, overwhelmingly provide good, decent coverage to their workers. So the issue is, how do we get at the service sector and the related sectors where uninsurance is just part of the way that business is much more normally done?
We're talking this hour about what states are doing to expand access to health insurance, what they're trying to do. You can join the discussion by giving us a call at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And with me is John McDonough with Healthcare for All, a consumer health advocacy organization in Massachusetts. John, the other part of this ambitious and some would say controversial plan is the individual mandate. And the best way to describe it is individuals will be required to buy health insurance much as individual auto owners are required to buy insurance for their cars. It sounds tough. It sounds even sort of punitive. How is someone who can't afford health insurance going to be able to do it if the government just says you got to do it?
Well, the formula in the House legislation would clearly tie it to affordability so that no one who has any serious problems with being able to afford coverage would in any way be affected by this mandate. It is recognized through some good studies that have been done that it's not a large, but there is a significant number of folks in Massachusetts who are making, say, over six times the federal poverty level, say a single adult making over $80,000 to $90,000. There's about 50,000 to 60,000 of them that don't purchase coverage. And they clearly could. Many of them are offered it by their employers, and they choose not to take it. And so there is a sense that it would be helpful for the Commonwealth, it would be helpful for the overall health market, and it would actually help those people if, in fact, they stepped up to the plate and did purchase coverage. It's controversial for my organization and for our allies. We're willing to hold our nose and go along with this under two conditions. Number one, it has to clearly be implemented only where it's 100% affordable, and there's no dispute about that. And secondly, we'll step up to the plate and say, okay, we'll take an individual mandate only if employer responsibility is also part of it. So if employers step up, then we'll say, yeah, individuals should too. But if the employer piece falls off the table, then all bets are off, and we're not going to take an individual mandate without employers being part of the solution. And that's what the public wants overwhelmingly. The public thinks that solving this problem has to be a shared solution and a shared responsibility. So individuals, businesses, and government all have to have a piece of this, and that's what really stands out in the conversation we're having right now.
Interesting. Now, here's a criticism, another criticism I've heard, and you and I have talked about this, and that is that this sort of approach that's being pushed in Massachusetts and to varying degrees elsewhere in the country is this, that our healthcare delivery system is fantastically ornate and complicated, colossal bureaucratic nightmare for many people. We have multiple private insurers with huge administrative costs, complicated rules, copays, deductibles, and so on. It creates the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Doesn't plan, don't plan like this, just sort of tinker around the edges and do more of the same.
Guilty, guilty, guilty.
Aha.
You know, I wish that we were in a place right now in Massachusetts and even more so nationally where we were talking about revolutionizing our healthcare system because it's awful. It's an affront to humanity. But there is simply and absolutely no societal consensus on how to fix this mess. It's interesting, you know.
You mean a consensus, for example, to go a single payer route and
exactly.
just say let's nationalize this and do what Canada does and simplify it and
it's interesting. There is now a growing consensus between the right and the left that our employer-sponsored system stinks and is terrible and is wasteful and inefficient. However, with that common agreement, the two political perspectives then go in polar opposite directions. The political left says, therefore, we need to have government take over the whole system, national health care a la Canada or Great Britain, and that'll be the solution. And the political right says, no, 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 we agree employer-sponsored coverage has to go, but what we want to see is let's put all the responsibility on individuals. Everybody's their own bottom. The same way that pensions went from defined benefits and everybody in the pool to 401ks and everybody's responsible, that's the vision. And that's the vision actually of the Republican Party nationally and President Bush. Health savings accounts, consumer-driven health care, they're actually gaining much more ground in the conversation and the process of where our health system is evolving, much more than folks on the left looking for a nationalized solution or an all-government plan.
We've got to take a short break, but let me ask very quickly first, what happens if we do nothing? In other words, if Massachusetts and other states don't take advantage of what you call the sort of this new opportunity and perhaps this new emerging political consensus of the right and the left that something needs to be done?
Probably an accelerating increase in the number of uninsured, definitely a steady degradation of the insurance coverage that people have, increasing distress for health care providers who have to care for these growing numbers of folks.
Okay, stand by, John McDonough. We're going to be coming back and continuing this conversation. On Point listeners, we're going to be asking you in this hour what you think about the emerging crisis of the uninsured. What should states be doing? Should taxes be raised on businesses? Do you believe in the idea of individual mandates? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the way some states are stepping in to fill the gap when it comes to health insurance. You can join the conversation. Should everyone be required by law to have health insurance? What about government-paid universal health coverage like they have in other countries, Canada, for example? What about individual mandates and new taxes on businesses like that's being proposed in Massachusetts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with John McDonough, Executive Director of Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. And now we're joined from Washington by Alan Weil, the Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, a nonprofit policy organization. And Alan, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Michael Cannon, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. And Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me bring you two into the conversation. A question first for Alan Weil. Put what's happening in Massachusetts. John McDonough talked about it as a possible emergence of a sort of new consensus between right and left about the need to do something about this problem. How do you see it? Put it in a sort of broader national context about this debate.
Well, I think John's got it about right. Discussions about how to expand healthcare coverage to more people are happening around the country. They go in cycles with the economy and concerns about healthcare costs and coverage. Massachusetts is at the front end of a current wave as states have pulled out of the economic downturn from 2001. And the Massachusetts approach is unique, or at least the discussed approach there is unique. But the notion of states trying to figure out how to address this problem is not unique to Massachusetts. That conversation is certainly going on around the country.
Yeah, and can you, is it easy to characterize? I mean, I know we mentioned in the intro that there are some 19 or 20 states that are having similar debates right now and proposals to do the same thing. Is there a common thread that runs through them? Is there a way that you can sort of characterize the range of options that are being discussed?
Well, I think the common thread is that they're practically oriented, unlike the debate in Washington, which is completely at a standstill because, as John described, the left and the right have extremely different views about how to approach this issue, and they just sit on either side of the fence and do nothing. At the state level, there is much more of an emphasis on practical solutions, and there's more of a willingness to get beyond the ideological positions and say, you know, we have a problem here. We have real businesses. We have real people. We have real issues and real cost pressures, and we need to roll up our sleeves and figure out what to do. So I think there's much more of an openness to compromise at the state level. I think if you compared the state-level conversations to the discussions in Washington, you'd find they're much more around the center, and they're much less ideologically driven.
Michael Cannon, let me draw you into this conversation. Same question to you. What do you see happening from coast to coast in some of these states with regard to this discussion?
Well, I also agree with John that there's a consensus among those on the left and those on the right that the employer-based system is not working very well, and that most of the movement and most of the ground that's being gained is being gained by those who are trying to use market forces to make health care more affordable and to make health insurance more affordable. And that's coming in the form of health savings accounts primarily, but other types of consumer-directed health care. And there's actually been a lot of activity at the state level to clear a path for these new types of health insurance, particularly health savings accounts.
Now tell us, give listeners, but just before we get lost in too much technical talk about this problem, give listeners a sense of how a health savings account would work.
Well, a health savings account actually has two components. One of them is a high-deductible insurance policy with a deductible of $1,000 or $2,000. But it's also attached to that. You have a health savings account into which you or your employer can contribute money tax-free on the same basis as your employer purchased insurance premiums. That money goes into your account, and you own it. And you can use that to spend or to purchase routine medical care. And whatever you don't spend, you get to keep. It rolls over and grows tax-free.
Hmm. What happens if it runs out, though? I mean, say I'm somebody without a lot of means and I've got a health savings account and I get some terrible sickness that requires huge expenditures and I run out of money in my health savings account.
Well, if you're able to contribute up to the amount of the deductible, so if you're able to do that, then in a given year you won't run out of money because you'll have full coverage. I'm among those who would like to see that contribution limit increased because then it would enable people to, you know, just have more security because if they can fund their account. But what's going on at the state level that has really been happening underneath the radar is states have really cleared a path for these for health savings accounts. They've deregulated their insurance markets at the margins in order to allow people to purchase health savings accounts because mm-hmm. a lot of mandated health benefit laws would have prevented that. And they've also made health savings account contributions deductible from state taxes as well. Not all states have done this. California recently passed a law that would tax at the state level contributions to health savings accounts, which really is going to hamper their growth.
Well,
this is a real as John said, there's a lot of activity in this area mm-hmm. and a lot of hope that and evidence that health savings accounts are making coverage more affordable for people.
Well, I wanted to ask John McDonough with Healthcare for All in Massachusetts. Good idea, health savings accounts. Is that one of the tools that could be used to stop the melting of this polar ice cap, as you called it?
No, we don't like it. I mean, we think of consumer-driven health care. The term we use for it is faith-based health insurance because you're supposed to pray that you don't get sick because what they're tied to, really, the health savings accounts are really the sheep in the wolf in sheep's clothing, and what's behind it is an aggressive degree of cost sharing being imposed on consumers. The data shows nationally that the average deductible for families with an HSA account is now $4,000. That means you get $500 or $750, but your insurance plan doesn't kick in until you've paid $4,000 out of pocket per year. And by the way, the tax benefits are totally regressive so that they benefit higher income people and lower income people get almost no benefit. So frankly, we consider it one of the scam solutions that are out there were totally disfavorable to it.
Okay, Michael Cannon, I assume you want to come back and sort of rebut that. So just give me a second because we've got a lot of callers who want to get on in this conversation, and they can do that by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And before we take a call, Michael Cannon, what do you say? That was quite an indictment about health savings accounts.
Well, first, I agree with a lot of the criticisms that John would probably make of health savings accounts. I'd say that it's not an example of cost shifting because workers are paying the cost of their health insurance through lower wages. That's where that money comes from anyway. But I don't think that health savings accounts should only be tied to catastrophic high deductible health insurance. I think people should be able to have a health savings account with any type of health insurance. And in a book that the Cato Institute released a couple months ago that I authored with a colleague of mine, we made a proposal that would actually provide significant tax benefits to low-income workers who currently get no tax benefit from the federal or state governments in order to purchase health insurance. So I think that there's more promise to them than John does, but I do agree with him on some of the criticisms.
Mm. Anthony, can I jump in?
Yes, please, and then I'm going to go to our callers as promised. But Alan Weil, please, yes.
Because we're going to have a discussion about health care, I think it's important for me to at least say that the debate over health savings accounts is really a sideshow, and I hope we don't spend our time talking about it. First of all, the state role with respect to HSAs is extremely limited. The path to HSAs was cleared by the federal tax changes. Second of all, they do nothing to address the primary reason people don't have coverage and employers don't offer coverage, which is affordability. As Michael said, you have to fund the account that fills in your deductible. If you don't have enough money to purchase coverage, you don't have enough money to fill the account. There is really no evidence that they reduce cost in anything like the order of magnitude you would need to address the uninsured. So it's fine to have an ideological debate about whether or not they're a good or a bad thing, whether they fragment the market and the like. But if we're talking about serious approaches to try to reduce the number of people without health insurance, they're just mostly a non-issue.
Let's take a call. Phil is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Phil. What's on your mind?
I'm not talking about the health savings account. I'm all for those. But just a comment on the Massachusetts plan. I think when Massachusetts, it's admirable that they're looking at these options, but it would be worthwhile to take a hard look at Tennessee. I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee. And Tennessee also implemented a very generous health care program, TennCare, in the 1990s. And the Democratic governor, Phil Bredesen, is currently drastically slashing the rolls of that program because what started as a basic service for a lot of people just grew and grew as consumer advocacy groups brought lawsuits demanding more and more levels of higher and higher levels of coverage. And it just became unaffordable to the point that education and other important state services were suffering.
Now, Michael Cannon, I've done some thanks a lot for that call, Phil. This is an important point. I've read some of your reading on this. You're concerned about precisely this issue of Medicaid growing and growing and growing and losing control of it, essentially. Is that
well,
fair?
I hope we can get back at some point to health savings accounts because I disagree with Alan. I think they are central.
We'll get
to
back,
this whole
but
debate.
let's let the listeners but guide on, this discussion for a moment.
But on that point, I think the caller is correct. There is in 1996, Congress reformed welfare because there was an enormous, what I like to call pay for dependence incentive in the way that the federal government funded the program. They funded they rewarded states who made more people dependent on a welfare check. They recognized that mistake in 1996, and they eliminated that perverse incentive. But we still have that perverse incentive in Medicaid. The federal government rewards states for making people dependent on Medicaid. And
how do they do that? Why do you say that? How do they do that?
Every dollar that a state puts toward its Medicaid program, the federal government matches with another dollar. For some states, it's as many as four additional dollars. So you have states doubling or even quintupling their money by expanding their Medicaid programs. And there's been a lot of evidence that there are people on Medicaid who could afford private insurance. Medicaid has been shown to crowd out private insurance as employers drop it for those workers who are eligible for Medicaid, and those workers will often just choose Medicaid. Mm. So I think the caller is right, and that is one of the reasons why private health insurance has become so expensive is because there has been this crowd out effect. Medicaid makes private health care more expensive and drains private insurance pools of a lot of consumers who could be helping lower premiums for everyone else.
We really challenge those conclusions.
Yep.
I mean, Medicaid does not crowd out private insurance. Overwhelmingly, the people who are on Medicaid are poor adults, poor senior citizens, disabled folks, and poor mothers taking care of their families. I mean, that's the lion's share. And the expansion to higher income is a minimal part of Medicaid. And Medicaid is an essential part of the nation's health care safety net. And its cost increases have been less than the rise of private health insurance coverage. Medicaid costs are going up because we have not been willing to bite the bullet and control health care spending in this country. That's the challenge. The challenge is not to scapegoat Medicaid, which is just trying to hold a system together for the most vulnerable people in society.
Let's take a call. Mary is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, Mary.
These discussions drive me absolutely around the bend. You should not be discussing what the states are going to be doing. I lived in Italy 43 years ago under a universal health plan system for a year, and again in England for a year. So far, those countries have not collapsed under the burden of medical care. A few years ago, the WHO did some health stats. Italy was number one. We were number 38, below a lot of developing countries. I think the disgrace is in these convoluted, ridiculous systems that you people are talking about. Why can't I ever hear a discussion of universal health care, plain and simple, across the board, instead of having someone say to me, well, it won't work here? I want to find out why not. I mean, what are you people talking about again?
Well, Mary, when you talk about a universal plan, you're talking about a universal plan that is run out of Washington, D.C., for example, correct?
I already do. I already belong to one that's called Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw that question.
I have no complaints about that one.
Okay. I very much appreciate the call. It's a great point. It's one that's debated again and again. And let's throw that out to Alan Weil. Alan, talk to Mary about her frustration. And why is it that this country, it seems like the third rail of when it comes to health care reform, whenever this subject comes up?
Well, the answer to Mary's question is very complicated, just like the healthcare system. Some of it's politics, some of it's economics, some of it is the large and diverse nature of the country. I share her frustration, but I work every day with states that are trying to address this issue, and they feel equally frustrated but unwilling to sit on the sidelines while Washington debates this again and again and again without making progress and, in fact, often taking steps backwards with respect to insurance coverage. So believe me, I think most of the state officials I work with would be comfortable with the notion that there would be at least a national framework. It might well play out differently from state to state, just as many other countries have a national commitment to universal coverage but permit variation around their countries as they are varied as we are. But, these are real problems, real people, real cost pressure, real businesses complaining. And state legislators and governors are responsive to that. So we can debate why we're frustrated, but I think it's more important to try to figure out how we move forward. And today, since we don't see much evidence of progress at the national level, people who want to make progress are working at the state level. I think that's a good thing, even if it's not the perfect answer.
1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. To join the discussion on health care reform and how we expand coverage to help the uninsured. Jamie is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I appreciate your discussion so much. It's been a frustrating topic for me, and I'm glad people are talking about
it. Why has it been frustrating for you? Tell me your story.
I'm a physician, but I'm also, with my husband, a small business owner. And we employ a lot of people who make minimum wage or a little bit above. We'd like to pay them more, but that's another story. And this year, at great cost to us, we instituted a health insurance plan for our employees who, when we acquired the business, did not have one. And they can't even afford the absolute minimum we are asking them to contribute. Mm. These are people who may be taking home $600 a month, and if you're asking them to give you $50 a month or $60 a month, they just can't do it. We see a complete failure at the federal level of taking care of these people who are barely economically stable and very fragile. They could be out on the street at any time. And if the federal government isn't going to do it, I applaud the efforts of the states to try and do it. I would love to see something here in South Carolina along the lines of Medicare.
Okay, Jimmy, we got your point, and we very much appreciate it. John McDonough, very quickly, we're going to go to another break, but I see you nodding your head at what Jamie's saying.
Well, it's simply a matter of justice that we as a society figure out how to provide basic health services. Every other country's done it. Just going back to Mary's call for a second, you know, the United States spends, let's say, 100 cents on the dollar. The second most expensive country in the world is Switzerland, and they spend 68 cents for every dollar we spend, and every other country does less than that in spending. Every other country covers all their people and has better health outcomes than we do. We've just got to recognize we've got the worst system in the world, not the best.
We're talking about how states are responding to what many say is a growing crisis of the uninsured. With health care reform dead in Washington, do the states have the answers to this vexing problem? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the way some states are stepping in to fill the gap when it comes to health insurance. You can join the conversation. Do you have health insurance? Are you going without it? Why? Are you a business, a small business owner who's concerned about the idea of new taxes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests this hour are Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Healthcare Policy, Michael Cannon, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and John McDonough, Executive Director of Healthcare for All. And Michael Cannon, I wanted to start this segment with a question to you and a theme, and that is cost. I mean, it seems like a lot of these plans, and I know John McDonough will want to chime in on this, a lot of these plans talk about expanding access. I don't hear a lot of talk about containing cost, and that seems to be a big concern, and I gather it would be a big concern of yours.
Well, it is, and it really gets back to the issue that we were discussing right before the break. The reason why health spending is so great in this country is largely because we haven't imposed the kind of rationing that other nations have. Nations with either single payer or other types of programs for universal coverage. And that's really why that approach has received the bad rap that it has, because while they hold down spending, they actually increase costs by denying people access to health care. And if the caller, I think it was Jamie or Mary, is wondering why we haven't enacted that sort of program here in the U.S., I think really the death knell to that type of approach was delivered this June by not an ideological opponent of universal coverage, but by the Supreme Court of Canada, which handed down an opinion in June that stated that the waiting lines or the delays for treatment in Canada are real. They cause human suffering, and they are intentional. And not only that, but the Supreme Court of Canada found that those actually violate the fundamental human rights of Canadian citizens. For the government to prohibit cause these delays to occur and then prohibit the Canadian citizens from going out and purchasing health care on their own. So I think that's that was a pretty tough blow that was dealt to supporters of a single-payer system, and it's I think it's going to be the death knell to those sorts of approaches because they don't really minimize cost. They can minimize spending, but not cost. And I think the challenge is we in the U.S. tend to err on the side of excessive spending. I think the challenge is really who's going to find the best way to really minimize cost, both in terms of spending and in terms of bad health outcomes.
Well, let me throw that
over
to...
I think that the way to do that is through expanded market forces, and I think health savings accounts are a down payment on that kind of reform.
Okay, well, the point about health savings accounts has been taken and debated. But John McDonough, I mean, let me just push you a little bit on a plan like the Massachusetts plan that's being debated here. It's all about expanding coverage. It is going to cost more. It is going to raise taxes on businesses. What's being done? Does it include efforts to contain cost? Because the cost is what seems to spiral out of control year after year after year.
It does contain those, but those are marginal. Those are on the margin of this plan. The central thrust of this plan is addressing the issue of the uninsured. I wish that we did have a societal consensus in the United States about how to approach controlling costs, but we really don't. And I think that's what's reflected in the inability to approach it. I just take issue with a couple of things that Michael said. Number one, the notion that we don't have rationing in the United States is absurd. We have rationing by people's ability to pay. People are denied services. People with good coverage will wait, you know, weeks and months to get an appointment. And the notion that every other system on the planet is done either like Canada as a single payer is not true. Most other systems on the planet actually have multiple payers. They have employer-based coverage. And it's just not true that it's all about Canada, and that's the only other way.
I want to just bring in one more voice to this conversation. Bill Walczak is on the line from Boston. He is the CEO of the Codman Square Health Center. This is a health center that provides health care to a lot of people in inner-city Boston, lots of working-class families, lots of people without health insurance. And, Bill, thanks for joining us. And the reason I wanted to bring you in this conversation is you're sort of on the front lines. You see a lot of people without health insurance. You provide health care for them. What have you heard in this hour? What do you think needs to be added to this discussion to help the kind of clients that you serve?
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for doing this. I think the issue for us is that, you know, that oftentimes when policy hits the street, you're dealing with real-life situations now, and then, you know, how do people react to those policies? Yeah. So in order to understand what to do about people that don't have health insurance, you have to understand who those people are, what their issues are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for instance, you know, who are the people without insurance? We have 42% of the patients at the Codman Square Health Center don't have health insurance. Who are they?
42%.
Well, 42%. Mm-hmm. Now, and that's down actually from 49% last year. But who are they? I mean, they're the people that bust the tables in the restaurants. They're the people that clean the office buildings and hospitals. They're the people that do the things for all of us insured people so that we can go to work and have our services. They work for McDonald's and Walmart. They have several part-time jobs. But I want to make something very clear about the uninsured. They all work. They are working people, but they just have employers that don't offer them a health insurance policy, or they have an employer that offers them a really expensive health insurance policy. But the other thing about them is that oftentimes these folks are very economically marginal. We did a study actually with Brandeis on health medical debt and found out that 38% of the people walking in the door had substantial medical debt, to say nothing of all the credit card debt and all the other kinds of debt that people have. So the whole idea of, you know, individual mandates or individual accounts, we call health savings accounts, is absurd for that population. They're not going to be able to come up with a couple of $100 a month in order to provide get their health care provided for.
So Michael Cannon, respond to Bill Walczak, who's in the trenches there at the Codman Square Health Center in Boston.
Well, I think that, as I mentioned before, we do see shortcomings with health savings accounts, and we've made proposals that would make it easier for low-income individuals to access health savings accounts and fund them. But I think it's important to point out that as these health savings accounts and other sorts of consumer-directed health plans have hit the marketplace, we started to see some changes. We started to see providers making basic care more convenient and more affordable to people through things like clinics in Walmart and in drugstores and the like. And I would argue that that's not an accident, because these types of health insurance are encouraging patients to shop around to make sure they're getting the most for their dollar. They are spurring these kind of innovations and efficiencies that are going to make healthcare more affordable for the very sorts of people that Bill is talking about.
Well, you know, the issue with that, though, is frankly, we have to make access to care easier for people, not more difficult. The danger in having these systems of care where people jump through hoops and have all sorts of policy issues that they have to deal with, you know, there's an old saying, you pay now or you pay later with interest. And it's very, very expensive when you deal with the healthcare system. You know, we have women who have waited to, for fear of the cost, resulting in, you know, with, for pap smears, resulting in cervical cancer, that not only costs women their health, but also costs the healthcare system a lot more money. You know, people that fail to get prostate cancer tests, people who don't get abdominal masses checked out, let their teeth go into abscesses because they're afraid of encumbering debt from the healthcare system. What we need to do is we just need to make this a simple, easy system for people to get care. I applaud Massachusetts for moving in that direction, but it really needs to be thought of as a simple way, and healthcare really needs to be seen as a right.
So, Bill, you see Massachusetts moving in the right direction, but not addressing this issue of simplifying the system, essentially.
Well, we have a very, very serious patchwork quilt problem in America in general. I mean, Massachusetts is great because it cares, it believes that healthcare is a right, but it also is developing a system that doesn't gore any oxes in this debate. So, you know, so are we creating a cheaper system? Probably not. But are we, you know, making more access available? Yes, we're definitely moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And maybe America isn't ready for a single payer system, but we need to figure out ways of moving in that direction.
All right, Bill Walczak. Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. Bill Walczak is the CEO of the Codman Square Health Center in Boston. Thanks, Bill, for taking part in this discussion.
Thanks, Anthony.
Alan Weil, let me just sort of throw that last idea that Bill Walczak put out there, and that is, are there any plans as you look around the country at what's happening that actually simplifies? I mean, we've talked about the need for increasing access. We've talked about cost. What about this idea of simplifying?
Well, I do think the Massachusetts approach is designed to simplify, although it does layer on top of the broader system that we have. But I think the exchange you just heard between Bill and Michael represents exactly why we have so much trouble here. We can talk about this at the sort of broad symbolic level of savings accounts and, you know, which are now a tiny, tiny sliver of the market, or we can talk about real people who have trouble coming up with $5 for a copayment. And it's like we're in two completely different worlds. Mm-hmm. And states, I think, are trying to bridge that gap at the national level. It's as if the two worlds never even connect.
Alan Weil, thank you so much. I think we're going to have to end the discussion there because we're out of time. Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Alan, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michael Cannon, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Thank you, Michael, very much.
Thank you.
And John McDonough, thanks for coming into the studio. John McDonough is Executive Director of Healthcare for All, a consumer health advocacy organization in Massachusetts. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And thank you, callers. In a moment, one woman's daily struggle to pay for her healthcare. This is On Point. Carol Lees learned she had Gaucher disease when still a teenager. The disease enlarges the spleen and liver and weakens the bones. Its victims worldwide are fewer than 10,000. It can cause tremendous discomfort, and without treatment, it's fatal. Until 1991, there was no treatment for the disease. When Lees first heard of a new drug, she hoped her life would change, and it has. But she still endures tremendous pain, and today has a whole new set of worries.
The main thing was they sent me home and said there is no treatment. There's some research being done, maybe at NIH, maybe at someplace in New York, but there was nothing. Basically, they just said, don't ride horses, don't go skiing, be careful not to fall, and you're not going to live very long, you're probably going to have problems. But they didn't say exactly what. So I went back to the University of Michigan. I was a composer in the music school. Tried to continue my education. I got about 4 months into it before my spleen just blew up, and in an emergency surgery, I needed to have it removed. So that was a tough year. And then I had a few moments of relief after that, before the bone stuff really came on heavily. I was hit with a major bone crisis. My husband and I were at Yale at the time, and nobody knew what to call it, or nobody knew what I had, or whether it was related to Gaucher's. It's just that suddenly I really literally could not move any of my joints. They were swollen, they were warm. It was not an infection. I was put in splints and into a bed for about 8 weeks, put on morphine, and just left there. The pain was really excruciating. I'd be still on pillows and in a splint, and if someone walked in the room, the vibrations of the footsteps would hurt my knees and my hips. It was that weird. It was very difficult. It finally eased on its own after the 6 or 8 weeks of going through that. No one knew what to do about it all through it. The doctors were on the phone, and someone in Boston told my doctor at Yale that this was called a bone crisis, and that sometimes children with Gaucher's had it, but they had never seen it in an adult. During these years that I was sick, because I'm very determined and a little stubborn, I kept trying to have a life and a career. I scored a film. I was the first woman to score a film. I wrote music for theater. I co-created a Broadway show. I just really did not want to give in to being sick if I didn't have to. The enzyme, which literally is a missing enzyme I was born without, was isolated at the National Institute of Health. It was recreated from human placenta. It cost a fortune. It took I don't know how many millions of placentas to get one dose of this. Very, very expensive process. It was given to 7 or 12 children. They responded well. They had a reversal of symptoms. And on my 44th birthday, I went to Children's Hospital here in Los Angeles with my husband and sat in the teddy bear room with a crash cart and the defibrillators and everything, because no one knew what was going to happen. And this bag of IV dripped into my veins, and I didn't have any reaction. I sat there for 4 hours. I came home and slept for about 4 weeks straight, because it had seemed like the end of a huge journey. And within months, my blood count went up, and my platelets went up. And within a year, I began to see my liver go down just a little bit, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. And it was truly miraculous. It was absolutely miraculous. It costs $1,400 a day for this drug every day of every year, which comes to $601,000 a year. That's what it costs my insurance company, who kindly enough pays for this, because it is the only treatment, and without it I would die. Right now I have probably $40,000 of it sitting in the refrigerator next to the milk, because it comes here from Memphis in a cooler carton. It needs to be refrigerated. It needs to be mixed right before you get it. It's a very precious liquid, very expensive, very precious to me. I've spent over $7 million so far of insurance money on this drug. I have a problem with the amount of money that is spent, not because I doubt that the drug company needs this money to pay for the research and the cost of the medicine. I have a problem with it in a kind of existential way, that it costs me $1,400 a day to stay alive. And I often think, what did I do today that was worth it? And everyone tells me not to think about the money, but I can't help but think that there are other problems in this world that need attending to. How many lives can be saved in Africa? And here I am spending $601,000 a year on a medicine that makes me well, but not well enough that I can even really go out and take a walk now. And I know there's no price on life, but for some reason, I seem to have one on mine.
Carol Lees lives in Studio City, California. She was profiled in the Wall Street Journal in an article entitled "A Biotech Drug Extends a Life, But at What Price?" Carol Lees composed the music you hear in her diary. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.